Daniela. Daniela Burkhardt is a leader in film studies at Royal Holloway, University of London. Her publications include Hollywood Behind the Wall, the Cinema of East Germany, co-edited anthology European Cinema in Motion, Migrant and Diasporic Film in Contemporary Europe, and Turkish-German Dialogues on Screen, a special issue of New Cinema. She was principal investigator of an AHRC-funded project on migrant and diasporic cinema in contemporary Europe, and currently holds an AHRC fellowship researching diasporic family in cinema.
Thank you. So my paper today is part of a larger project which explores the representation of the diasporic family in cinema, and it's based on the premise that the representation of the family constructs the family as the most important site of social and cultural reproduction, as well as a trope of national belonging. And this is where the coordinates of family and citizenship, addressed in the title of our panel today, Citizens of Plural Worlds, Family and Nation in the Age of Globalization, intersect. Traditionally, the nation has been imagined in terms of a patriarchal family structure. The familial trope serves to naturalize structures of power and of subordination. But this is not the only correspondence between the family and the nation state. In fact, both are equally obsessed with demarcating their boundaries. The family mobilizes discourses of inclusion and exclusion to preserve its lineage and cultural identity. It is highly selective about who is allowed to join the circle of the family, for example through marriage, and who is expelled when violating values by which the family abides. This kind of boundary demarcation is particularly crucial for the diasporic family, which is perpetually negotiating its values and traditions in relations to the majority culture of the host society and the culture of origin. Nation states engage in similar negotiations, determining who is included and who is excluded, who is a citizen and who is a national and who is not. Laws on citizenship or nationality derive from either jus sanguinis, based on descent from a national of the country concerned, or jus solis, based on birth in the territory of the country. But in the age of transnational mobility and globalization, citizenship based on bloodline and descent has become highly problematic and is being assessed against more flexible forms of citizenship. So in my presentation on secrets and revelations in the diasporic family, and I left out family feuds because I just couldn't explain the family conflicts and feuds to such an extent, it would have been beyond 20 minutes, so it's Secrets and Revelations in the Diasporic Family, I hope to demonstrate that family secrets such as illegitimate birth and queer desire, especially when interracial, put a threat to the stability of the family and force the family to reassess its rules and boundaries, as it were. In this equation of family and nation, the diasporic family's capacity to accept the other, configured either as an illegitimate child or as a queer son or daughter, would correspond with a nation state's capacity to integrate the other. In her book, Family Secrets, Acts of Memory and Imagination, Annette Kuhn proposes that families are held together as much by their shared remembering as by their complicit forgetting, and that narratives about the family are crucially concerned with the construction of individual and group identities. Such narratives, Annette Kuhn says, are shaped as much by what is left out of the account, whether forgotten or repressed, as by what is actually told. Secrets haunt our memory stories, giving them pattern and shape. Family secrets are the other side of the family's public face, of the stories families tell themselves and the world about themselves. Characters and happenings that do not slot neatly into the flow of the family narrative are ruthlessly edited out. this editorial process actually works has been studied in particular in the context of the transgenerational transmission of traumatic or shameful family secrets. In their study, The Shell and the Kernel, the psychoanalyst couple Nicholas Abram and Maria Torok explore how undisclosed family secrets become phantoms which haunt subsequent generations. And I quote, "The phantom is the formation of the unconscious that has never been conscious, for good reason. It passes from the parent's unconscious into the child's. Secrets such as incest, child abuse, adultery, illegitimacy, homosexuality, and other perceived social stigmas that are not talked about but forgotten manifest themselves as phantoms, that is, memory gaps, which then haunt the children or grandchildren and which may compel them to reveal their ancestor's secret by reenacting it." Mira Nair's film Mississippi Masala illustrates how an undisclosed family secret, and one that is neither made explicit in the film nor widely addressed in critical discourse, is reenacted in the following generation. The film centers on an Indian family whose migratory trajectory takes them from Uganda, from where they are expelled under General Idi Amin's campaign to reclaim Africa for black Africans in 1972, via Great Britain to America, where they settle in a small town on the Mississippi. Through the theme of interracial romance between Mina, the only daughter of Jay and Kinuloha, and the African-American Demetrius, the film explores the race relations between the South Asian and the black diaspora in the United States. Mina's value on the marriage market within the South Asian community is low on account of her unusually dark complexion, coupled with her family's relative poverty. Mina once describes herself as a masala. She says, "I'm a mixture, a bunch of hot spices," and she conceives of herself as the embodiment of hybridity, simultaneously African, Indian, and American. The film offers a number of subtle clues that she is half African, not just by virtue of being born in Uganda, but also in terms of her descent, suggesting that she is the illegitimate, racially mixed child of her mother Kinu and the Ugandan family friend Okelo. There is, for example, a treasured photograph showing Mina and Okelo rather than her presumed father Jay, which her mother rescues amongst the small number of possessions that she is able to take when fleeing from Uganda, and which she keeps on display in her liquor store in Greenwood, Mississippi. A further clue is provided in the scene at the bus station in Uganda. There's a kind of flashback early on in the film, where Mina's family bids a hasty and tearful farewell to their black African friends. Her mother, Kinu, and Okelo are shown in an embrace that is much more intimate than one would expect if Okelo were merely her husband's best friend. Her husband, Jay, who observes the farewell, looks distinctly uncomfortable. Moreover, the fact that Jay feels betrayed politically by Okelo during Idi Amin's racial homogenization campaign, wrongly so as it turns out later, reflects the ambivalent undercurrent of the two men's friendship. Yet the film remains equivocal about Mina's parentage and the family secret. Mina's choice of the African-American Demetrius as her lover suggests that there is an unconscious affinity to the other race, and perhaps a desire to repeat her mother's secret. Unlike her mother, Mina comes out in the open. Although racial prejudice results in the exclusion of the couple from the Asian family and community, Mina's decision is depicted in positive terms. The couple's new life together begins at a petrol station on the open road, an apt metaphor for the diasporic condition of being at home nowhere. What lies ahead of Mina and Demetrius is the prospect of what Jinga Desai has called in her book Beyond Bollywood an unfettered, unlimited, and celebratory mobility, and the possibilities of renewal and rebirth inherent in the notion of roots, R-O-U-T-E-S, as opposed to roots. But by far the most common secret harbored within the diasporic family is what Oscar Wilde euphemistically referred to as love that dare not speak its name. What Oma and Johnny in My Beautiful Laundrette, Vaitung and Simon in The Wedding Banquet, Lola, Billy, and Murat in Lola and Bilidikit, Alim and Giles in Touch of Pink, Emra and Tim in Yvette, I Do, and one could add quite a number of titles to this list. What they all have in common is that they are involved in a gay or lesbian relationship, in most cases with a partner who belongs to the white majority culture, and that their families do not know anything about it until their secret is revealed. What interests me in relation to this particular family secret is how queer and diasporic identities relate to discourses of inclusion and exclusion pertaining to familial and national belonging. Queerness and diaspora are often constructed as theoretical twins. Both are hybrid identity categories characterized by crossovers and mergings. They resist containment within clearly demarcated borders such as gender and the nation state. In the words of Gayatri Gopinath in her book Impossible Desires, queerness is to heterosexuality as the diaspora is to the nation. Following the logic of this equation, the queer subject is the heteronormative family's other, and the diasporic subject is the nation's other. The coming out of queer sons and daughters in the diasporic family therefore functions as a critique of nationalist discourses which stigmatize mergings between different cultures as undesirable. I want to illustrate this hypothesis by taking a closer look at Nina's Heavenly Delights, a film by Pratibha Parmar that has been described as a masala, a mixture between romantic comedy, fairy tale, and some upmarket cookery program. Like Mississippi Masala, Parmar's film also configures the family secret as a transgenerational phantom. But the phantom haunting Nina is neither a shameful family secret, nor does it relate to her queer desire. Instead, the phantom is the benevolent and helpful ghost of her deceased father. And here's the plot. Nina ran away from her family after breaking off her engagement, and she returns to Glasgow after many years she spent in London in order to attend her father's funeral. When she takes over her father's restaurant, the New Taj, she finds out that it has been partly gambled away and is now co-owned by Lisa, the woman with the blue headscarf in the picture. She also learns that the New Taj has been shortlisted for the Best of the West curry competition. Nina, who was initiated into the secret art of cooking by her father when she was still a little girl, is confident that she will win by simply following her father's advice, mentioned at the beginning of the film, and here's a flashback. Taste it in your heart, no matter what the recipe says, always follow your heart. Best chicken chakuti this side of Maryhill. One day you're going to the best cook in Glasgow. As David Martin Jones observes in his insightful analysis of the film, cooking is a way for Nina to recreate her father's presence from her childhood and to keep via the family the cultural memory alive. Though significantly, this is not the memory of a homeland like India, but of a diasporic NRI childhood in Maryhill, Glasgow. Spending time with Lisa in the kitchen and exploring the sensuous delights of exotic food, Nina grows ever more attracted to Lisa until one day they fall into each other's arms and passionately kiss. But Nina is worried that the revelation of her secret desire might result in her being exiled from her family. Her fear is, however, hardly credible, given that Nina's mother appears to be quite open-minded about Nina's childhood friend Bobby, an out-gay drag queen involved with a white Scottish man from his dance ensemble, the Chutney Queens. But then Nina discovers that she is not the only one in the family with a secret. Her brother is secretly married to a white Scottish woman. Her little sister secretly indulges in traditional Scottish dancing. And her mother has been secretly in love with Raj, the owner of the Jewel in the Crown, a competitive curry restaurant. Only after Mr. Shah's death does the entire family come out with their secrets, and everyone lives up to Mr. Shah's legacy. They all follow their heart, never minding the recipe, never minding the rules and social norms that govern traditional Indian family life. But rather ironically, it turns out that Mr. Shah would have approved of these secrets all along. His ghost, for example, helps Nina and Lisa win the Best of the West curry competition. And when Nina and Lisa celebrate their victory with a nationally televised kiss on Korma television, there is no doubt that Mr. Shah gives them his blessing. In other words, the ghost of Mr. Shah fully accepts the hybridization of the Indian family values in the diaspora space, which is different from the diaspora itself. As Aftab Brown has noted in her book Cartographies of Desire, Cartographies of Diaspora, another good book title here. Aftab Ra describes the diaspora space as a conceptual space of confluence, entanglement, and the intertwining of the diasporian and the indigenous. It is a space where multiple subject positions are juxtaposed, contested, proclaimed, disavowed, where the permitted and the prohibited perpetually interrogate, and where the accepted and the transgressive imperceptibly mingle, even while being disclaimed in the name of purity and tradition. In a bid for mainstream audiences, Parmar's film remains extremely coy about the depiction of same-sex desire, translating erotic into culinary delights, and foregrounding romantic love over lesbian desire. Furthermore, by suggesting that Nina's secret is on par with her sister's innocent indulgence of traditional Scottish dancing, or her brother's pure love, an expression he uses several times in relation to his wife, and the film normalizes queerness. The grand finale, a hybrid Bollywood-style song and dance number performed by the entire cast, who joined Bobby and the Chutney Queens in their celebratory performance of Love in a Wet Climate, is a tongue-in-cheek endorsement of fluid identities, be they queer, diasporic, or both. I show the dance number at the very end because of technical difficulties, and I carry on, but we end on the little clip then. So in this dance number, not just the chutney queens are cross-dressing. Everybody is wearing ethnic drag. Some Scots wear Indian saris, and some diasporic Indians wear traditional Scottish tartanry. Parmar's feel-good movie presents the queer diasporic subject as fully integrated into the Scottish nation, imagined here in a deliberately cliched nature imagery, as used in the Scottish Tourist Board's advertising campaign Visit Scotland. Expansive, empty landscapes with high mountains and crystal clear lakes conjure up visions of a pure Scotland, and by extension, pure Scottishness. In the film's final shot, in which the performance of Love in a Wet Climate gives way to the filming of this performance in the studio, this vision of a pure Scotland is revealed to be fake. It is a landscape that has been projected onto a green screen. The film makes the point that the ideal of purity, be it pure, that is heterosexual love, or a pure, that is racially homogenous Scotland, are nothing but a pure fantasy. So let me conclude then by asking how these two films assess the integrative capacity of the diasporic family and of the nation. Meera Nair's assessment of the success of the American Melting Pot Project in Mississippi Masala is rather pessimistic. Mina's mixed racial origin is shrouded in silence, and the reenactment of her mother's secret in her passionate interracial romance with Demetrius results in her exclusion from the family and from the South Asian community. In Nina's Heavenly Delights, by contrast, the generic framework of the romantic comedy provides the utopian space in which queer interracial desire is accommodated in the family and in the nation. This is achieved by representing erotic delights as culinary ones. Just as Indian curries and Bollywood rhythms make Scotland richer and more vibrant, so does diversity in love. Thank you.